Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Look, you would not believe that we're recording today's podcast the day after the Victims of Crime Commissioner here in Victoria released her report titled Silenced and Sidelined, which was, to be honest, a really disturbing report or insight into how victims of crime are treated by the justice system, from their initial report to police through to their experience in the court system, and how we can improve that experience. And as I said, it was really disturbing reading, and I only read, maybe the first chapter. But today's guest, Tammy Castleson, her story just highlights and confirms what the Victim of Crime Commission found in her report. What really frustrates me, though, is the fact that since 2016, there have been 7 reports into how victims of crime are treated in the justice system and what can be done to improve that experience. And, like, with all due respect to Fiona McCormack, the Victims of Crime Commissioner, nothing seems to have changed with those 7 reports. They all suggest ways to improve. We just seem to be going round and round in circles, and Tammy's story today is proof of that. Tammy Castleson had it all, or so it appeared. A carefree, happy childhood, happy upbringing, meets Mr. Handsome, Mr. Popular, Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Life of the Party, who also had a carefree, happy childhood and a happy upbringing, a happy life, right? Well, Tammy and her husband had also 2 adorable children, and everything just seemed perfect. But behind closed doors, Tammy didn't have it all. She was frightened. Her husband's behaviour was becoming more unpredictable. His bursts of anger, his yelling, his insults, his rage, his threats, and it wasn't only towards Tammy, but their children as well. Mr. Handsome had become Mr. Narcissist, Mr. Abusive, Mr. Vindictive, Mr. Controlling, Mr. Demeaning. Like so many other survivors of domestic and family violence, Tammy made excuses for his behaviour, not recognising or understanding the seriousness of his increasingly violent behaviour. It wasn't until an ill-fated attempt at taking his own life and ending up in hospital that Tammy found the courage to leave. That's when she realised that his abuse had included financial abuse, and she discovered that their finances were in shatters. They were non-existent. He'd kept it secret from her that they had nothing, and Tammy and her children were homeless. But then again, homelessness was a safer option than staying. How sad is that? How does a successful, educated, professional woman with a background in counselling, psychology and teaching become homeless? Tammy was dragged through the court system, where all the games her husband could have played, he did, along with his legal representatives, who she felt belittled and intimidated by. Tammy's husband eventually did end his life, but it left a lot of heartache and what ifs. What if they could have tried some type of amicable reconciliation? What if their children and their father could have mended some of their damaged relationship? What if he'd sought some help? His death became a senseless void, unable to be filled, and all because he refused to seek help. Oh, gee, Tammy, that's a hell of an introduction, but thank you so much for joining us and welcome to NFI.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Are you aware of the Victims of Crime Commissioner's report that was tabled yesterday, or released yesterday, I should say?
I am, yes. It's just, you know, you hope that things are going to get better, and then you talk to people in the streets and things are not getting better.
Mm. No, as I said in my intro, we seem to be going round and round in circles, don't we?
Yeah, you know, it's enough of talk, and it's time for action.
Mm. You're right. There's a lot of words. In fact, in this particular report, there would be thousands and thousands of words. And I'm not taking anything away from the Victims of Crime Commissioner. It is clear that it is a very, very, they've gone to in depth with what's going on. But they've made all these recommendations. In fact, I think there's 55 recommendations. But all these other reports from 2016, they've all made recommendations as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. The recommendations are great. Let's now see some action. Let's do something.
Mm. In fact, you have been doing something. Just before we were talking in preparation for today, and you told me about where you went the weekend. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, it was pretty amazing being in Sydney over the weekend at the LC conference. It's 50 years since a group of Sydney feminists broke into two adjoining vacant houses. The one was named LC, which is why the conference was called LC, and the other house was called Minnie. And they changed the locks, and they claimed squatters' rights. And the group was led by Dr. Anne Summers, who's just such an inspiration. Mm. And that group started a movement. And that movement has saved thousands of lives. That was the first of 800 refuges that helps thousands of women and children escape domestic violence. And being there with all these incredible women, there were over 500 women there and a scattering of men, just felt very inspiring, as I've said, and just a lot of people doing incredible things today, and hopefully we'll see further changes and action.
Mm. Yes, I think Dr. Anne Summers is very, very well known in the media, isn't she? She's a great advocate for women in general, but from what you're saying, you know, there's obviously a lot of things that she does behind the scenes, and what a fantastic initiative.
Absolutely. And, mm. and they were just sick of people not doing anything. They just got to the point where actions were needed to be done. And they did it.
And so what are they doing, let's say, any different to what the Victims of Crime Commissioner has suggested? Like, there's 55 recommendations. The LC conference, are they doing anything different to what the Victims of Crime have suggested? No. Over the years, I'm not necessarily talking about just this one report that's been released.
No, I think there's some consistency across the states. I mean, there obviously are some differences, like New South Wales has now just brought in coercive control laws, and hopefully we'll follow. But I think it's just about actioning things. And, you know, obviously across Australia, we have a major problem, a crisis, and it's just important to keep working. And it's just amazing, some of these women who've been working for such an extensive period of time. And while some things have improved, other things are just, you know, still desperately terrible. You know, the fact that so many women are dying. And a lot of it starts with coercive control.
And, you know, we haven't really heard about that word. It's never been spoken about as much, I don't think, until, let's say, the last couple of years, where we are now as a community realizing how detrimental to a relationship and how dangerous to a relationship coercive control is. And just by, I agree, Tammy, just by us talking about it, people are now starting to realize how important it is to understand what it is and how to recognize it.
Absolutely. And, that was what was so horrifying for me, is that this is the 50th anniversary of Elsie, and I'm turning 50 this year. And I did not know what coercive control was. And here I was in this relationship filled with coercive control and would not have been able to explain that to you. And so awareness and education is where we have to begin. And yes, it is starting to get out there, but I still think there's a lot of confusion around the terms. People don't really understand what gaslighting is, what coercive control is. And until we really all understand it and we talk about it, you know, I think people feel discomfort when talking about these things, and we have to talk about it. Until we talk about it, we're not going to get rid of it.
You know, it's true, Tammy, about people talking about it and starting to understand. I was with some friends on the weekend, and this man, he's my age, and he was talking about understanding what coercive control is, and it dawned on him that a particular person that he knows, that he spent quite a bit of time with, he realised that he was controlling his wife. Anyway, he called him out.
Oh, that's
and
amazing.
I think, how good is that? And this isn't because of me. This is just, he is now, he understands what control is, and he didn't like it, and so he's called it out. And I just think that's a great thing, that it is, we are getting through to people that it is unacceptable, and it's bloody dangerous. But just going back to, isn't that a huge step for New South Wales to be to now have coercive control as an offence? Like, that is, I know we say, you know, we keep going round and round in circles, but that's not going round in circles. Like,
no, it's not. It's really a huge step. Yeah, no, it's a huge step. But again, people need to be educated. People need to understand what it is. And the police need to be educated. And the law needs, you know, people all in the law system need to be understanding what it's about, so that people don't get misidentified. There's a huge fear of misidentification. So there's a whole process that has to go with it, but we need it here as well. Every state needs these laws in place, and the education has to be there.
And I think you're right. It has to start, like, with us talking about it. But if you go to the police, let's say, and they don't recognise what coercive control is and the danger of it, they are just going to say there's nothing we can do, you know, come back if it gets worse. And I'm not criticising the police, because the police need to be educated. Somebody needs to teach the police about what coercive control is, so that they can recognise it and do something about it.
Absolutely. I went multiple times, you know, crying, hysterical, to the police. I was sure I was going to be killed. I knew that he had threatened so many times. I was sobbing that the threats were just vile. And I was told, you know, come back when something happens. And there were a couple of policemen who took me very seriously, but their hands were tied and they just did not know where to take it. I did have an AVO, But he kept breaching the AVO, and I was so scared. It was desperate.
And see, there's no point. There is no point in having an AVO, an apprehended violence order. There is no point in having it if they are not charged with breaching that AVO.
No.
It's imperative we have that education, and from that front line, from the police. And so, Tammy, you've just spoken a little bit about your husband. Can we go back and can you tell us a bit about your marriage? How long into the marriage, let's say, did the cracks begin to appear, and maybe how you managed those cracks, or did you recognise them?
Yeah. The truth is that those cracks were probably there all the way from, you know, when we started going out. I was 15 when I met him, and I had no idea. There were these little fractures, these tiny little cracks, and I just kind of wished them away. I didn't recognize them as anything. They were tiny little things that nobody would know. He hated mess. He would, yell at me for making a mess, and I didn't want to make him upset. So I just would stop making a mess. I wouldn't bake. He didn't want me to go out with my friends. That would really upset him. And that is one of the big red flags. But I didn't. We only know that now. People talk about it now. We didn't talk about it then, and so it was very much an isolation thing. He would really want me to be with him all the time. I took that as, oh, he adored me and wanted to be around me. There was a time when him and one of my best friend's husbands organized for us to go away for a girls' weekend, but he doesn't like me leaving him. And so all weekend, I just kept getting these bombardments of abusive text messages that I'm disgusting for leaving him, that I've abandoned him, that I've abandoned the children, that I'll be sorry if something happens to them. It was the worst weekend ever. There were these tiny little flags and cracks all along, but I didn't actually recognize them.
But also, Tammy, you wouldn't recognize them because you didn't know what they meant. And like, I'm quite a bit older than you, but when we were kids, it was really, it sounds very old-fashioned, but it was about keeping our boyfriends happy, keeping them level-headed. Like, I would agree that if somebody wanted to know at 15, or, let's say early in the relationship, if somebody wanted to know where I was all the time, I'd think that was quite a compliment back in those days.
Absolutely. I didn't know better. It was the first time we ever had mobile phones a couple of years into our relationship. He would phone me over and over and over every day. And I just took it as, people laughed about it. They made fun of it. But that's part of stalking. He wanted to know where I was, where am I going next? And he used to follow me in the car to see where I was going, getting into the car, getting out of the car. But nobody actually said anything.
But I don't think they would, because in those days, as I said, it was almost like a compliment that my boyfriend can't stand to not know where I am and who I'm with. But now that is absolutely coercive control.
Totally.
And you said about those tiny cracks. So you said that, he wanted to know where you were all the time, the mess. So as you say, those little cracks, did they start to really annoy you at some point? Or I suppose when was it that you recognised that these cracks, they're really, it's not right?
I just thought it's his personality. Maybe he'll get better. I did always ask him to go to therapy. I did think that he was a bit excessive. I did start asserting myself and wanting to be a more individual person, and that's when things got worse. The only time it really got to me was when things got very extreme, and that would be like when one of my best friends passed away, and when she was dying, I just felt that he crossed the line, and he was not a support to me, and he was really very upset that I wasn't with him and was choosing to be at her bedside. And for me, that was like extreme. And I watched how my friends' husbands were sitting with them and being a support to them. And my husband was telling my children that I was abandoning them. And for me, that was the end of our relationship. I was done. I just felt like I can't make excuses anymore.
Like to me, I just don't understand that thought process, but then why would we?
No.
But the fact that you are supporting a friend who's dying and he can't see that, that is a narcissist to the nth degree, isn't it?
Where totally.
They absolutely, and I just sort of think how cruel, how could anybody think like that? You've got a friend dying and they want you to sit with them and, I don't know, watch a bit of telly or something.
It was devastating.
So wrong. Can you recall the first time that you felt unsafe or threatened by his behaviour?
We had bought a house together. And we were busy fixing it up because we were going to move into it after we got married. And I was painting the skirting boards in the home. And I was so excited about making it ours. And I had put a little bit of varnish into a cup. And the cup melted away and the varnish fell onto the newly laid carpets. And he started yelling abuse at me. I had never heard him yell like that before. And I was in total shock. In fact, his father was there helping with the cupboards. And he got such a fright that he said that he was leaving. And I actually just went into freeze. I just couldn't move. And then, of course, I started scrubbing and cleaning to try and get the mark out, the carpet. And I was just in shock, and I was just, he had become someone completely different in that moment. But it was also the first time that a good person turned away. Like, his father never said anything to him. He just walked away. And that would happen many times.
And I suppose that's where we're hoping that people now, like my friend on the weekend, where his father, let's go back a bit and, you know, say that it would be nice if his father said, that's not good enough. You cannot treat somebody like that.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Have a look at yourself rather than just ignoring it and letting it slide.
That's what we need. We need people to call out the behaviour. Absolutely.
I imagine that with your, well, it was your boyfriend at the time or your fiancé, like you're not even married.
No.
I don't imagine with, you said you had a really happy childhood. I don't imagine you'd ever heard anybody yell like that before.
My parents had an incredibly, in fact, they still have an incredibly happy marriage, but they did fight. They would fight and then they would.
We all do.
And then they would make up, you know. So I recognize that it's okay to fight. But not the things that he said were just incredibly mean and just beyond anything I had ever heard. And the problem with it is that there would be a threat and then there would be a reward. And that's what's confusing in these relationships. That's why it's so difficult to actually explain it or to see it, because that's the part of the gaslighting. There's this to-ing and fro-ing from things being really bad and then things being good. And so it's just so confusing. And you're trying to explain it in your first to yourself and then maybe to a person, and it just doesn't come out right.
Did you ever, in those early days, did you ever think about talking to somebody or talk to somebody about the way that your fiancé was?
In the early days, I didn't even recognise it as anything other than, you know, he's having a bad moment. And, you know, maybe I've pushed him too far. And then, which is rubbish, just for anybody thinking it is.
But
later in our relationship, you know, when I was really questioning, is something going on here, I did try and speak to a couple of people, literally two people. And I just couldn't explain it because I couldn't actually put the words out in my mind. I couldn't really He had totally made me question whether anything was happening. Only when I was out the relationship was I able to really start to verbalize what was going on. But when I was in the relationship, I couldn't actually see it for what it was.
You tried to tell people, but they didn't understand either. So how could anybody understand what was going on? Because this is Mr. Handsome, you know, Mr. Popular, Mr. Nice Guy. Everyone loved him, didn't they?
They did. He was so charming, and especially with other people. He never let down his guard with other people. He was always charming, always, you know, the life of the party with people. So nobody ever saw anything but that with other people.
And that's why I think other people find it so hard to believe you, is because they only see that Mr. Life of the Party side. You know, it's like a Jekyll and Hyde, isn't it, really?
Totally. They groom you, but they also groom the people around you. And that's why it's so difficult. And even when, you know, everything collapsed, it took people a long time to actually believe what had happened. And some people never, ever believed, because he played the victim. You know, he told people I had abandoned him. He told people he played the victim so well.
So we were saying that your friends didn't recognise it as abuse, but neither did you.
No.
So when did you realise that it was abuse? And how did you feel when you thought, my God, this is abuse, he is abusing me?
Well, the first time I realized that I had been really been lied to, and there'd been a lot of fraud, and I had been treated really badly, was when I had come home from the hospital and realized what the financial situation we were in, and realized that he had been lying to me for a long, long time. We were in a serious situation and I didn't know about it. And this has been going on for must be years and years and years. And then that kind of more information started coming out and more and more. And then talking to a lawyer and finding out more information, I realized how much betrayal there had been. And I realized there was a lot of terrible things happening. But then we were sitting in court the one day, and I looked down at the table in front of me, and there were these diagrams, and on them were the power and control wheels, the abuse wheels. And all of the tactics that are used in abuse were in these wheels. And I was going through them and thinking, oh my goodness, these all apply to me. How is this possible? I've been in an abuse situation. And I was in utter shock. They all resonated with me, and I couldn't believe it.
How long into the marriage, Tammy, was this when this was his first attempt, or his attempt at his life, when you talked about coming home from hospital? That was, I'm assuming, when you came home from visiting him in hospital.
It's crazy. It was 20 years of marriage and 27 years of being together.
Wow. That's a long time, isn't it?
It's like my whole life.
It's a long time. I was just going to say it's a long time for you to have to deal with this fear. You know, like the fear that you said that you thought at one point he was going to kill you. Like, that's how frightened you were. Like, to live that sort of a life, I just can't imagine.
So I didn't deal with fear the whole way through. That was more towards the end when I was, you know, wanting to leave him. That the threat started to come, that, you know, if I left him, he had come after me and something very bad would happen to me or the children. He also threatened something would happen to himself, and I never believed he'd do anything to himself. I did believe that something could happen to me or the children. So that's why I was being very careful, you know, how am I going to leave him? But the last 8 years where I had left him, that's when things really got worse. So when I had left him, that's where it really escalated.
Oh, I can't imagine, like, finding the strength to leave, but then that fear of and the threat of him harming you and the children. Like, I would imagine harming the children would just, that would be, oh, I don't know how people deal with that.
I just lived in survival mode. I just wanted to keep my children safe. That was all that was important to me. As long as my children were going to be safe, that was all that was important.
Can we go to, and this is when you left, you said that you were, or I said in my introduction, that you actually found yourself homeless. Can you share with us a little bit about how that felt and where you actually did sleep?
Yeah. So I didn't realize. I started in those last few months before everything happened, I started realizing that something was up with money. And it only then dawned on me that I didn't have any access to banking or money. I know that sounds ridiculous. When I say it, it sounds ridiculous to my ears.
No, it doesn't.
But we had been in a partnership. So since I was 15 years old, we had been saving money together. And he was looking after our money and I was looking after the children and the house. So I earned a living. I was working and my money would go into a joint bank account and then he would just give me whatever I needed for the week. But towards those last few months, at the end, I was asking him for access and asking him what money we had, because we had started, I had started receiving calls about money owing, and he was refusing me access. When he attempted suicide on his life, I came home that night when he was settled, and I looked next to his bed, and there was just all these envelopes. There were some opened and some unopened. And I found out that we were being evicted from our rental property, as well as finding a big bag of credit cards in both our names. There was just all these different things. Our cars were being repossessed, our phones. There was just bills to the school. This huge amount of money owing. And so, yeah, we had to leave the house.
And at this stage, was he still in hospital, recovering from his attempt on his life, or was he living? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so he had to stay. He stayed in the medical ward for. They kept him there for a couple of months, and then also in recovery. So that gave us a period of time to work with.
But what a conflicting position for you to be in. This is a man that you've loved and been with since you were 15. You've had two children with him, and you've trusted him. And why wouldn't you? He's your husband. You've trusted him all your life, and then you find out it's almost like a facade.
Totally. Yeah, it all just came tumbling down. I had stopped loving him. Like, after everything happened with my best friend, I was just living with him. He was like my left arm. Like, I never ever imagined us not being together. But our relationship was just very harmed by then. And when I found out about the money, I just felt a responsibility to him. I still felt, even though there was all this deceit and manipulation, I felt that I needed to look after him. So I would still go every single day to look after him, you know, to see that he was okay at the hospital. I was washing his clothes. I was taking him to, you know, Centrelink or doing whatever he needed to be done. And he was being so abusive. He's just was being absolutely terrible. But I would go every single day. The hospital staff were saying I need to go less often. That's all part of something called trauma bonding. But
tell me about that trauma bonding.
Yeah. So it's all part of coercive control, and something that happens with victims is that you form this unhealthy attachment. You just are totally connected to this person. You don't feel like you're going to be able to live without that person. And even when once I had told him that the relationship was over, I still felt this responsibility. I had to learn that I wasn't responsible for him. He was responsible for himself. He was making conscious decisions. And so I found him temporary housing. I found us temporary housing until we could find permanent housing. I was paying his expenses for a full year. He was still being so manipulative. You know, he would phone me when he got out, and he would say, "I don't have any money," even though I had given him money, you know, 2 days before. And he would say, "Oh, well, then I just won't eat today." So totally manipulative. And then I found out. After that year, that actually he had been for months and months been earning, getting insurance payouts, getting money from Centrelink, getting money from been working, and I was the one paying expenses for him and really struggling, and it was all just a manipulation.
Again, it was all just a facade.
It was further financial abuse.
How does somebody get to this point, Tammy? And the reason I ask that is, I wonder, do you have any idea what changed him? Or do you think that he was always possessed, or that he always possessed those behaviours or traits, like, say, his anger, his coercion, his cruelty, but somehow he was able to control them or suppress them? Do you think that that's always been in his personality?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I definitely think that it was always bubbling there. And I think that it's all about power and control. And I'm a very easygoing person. And as soon as I wasn't doing what he wanted me to do and he was losing the power and control, that's when it escalated. And you can see that with his behavior. So it just got, the threats and the abuse just got worse and worse as he lost the power and the control. And you see this with the most dangerous time for victims is when they're pregnant or when they leave. And that's exactly what happened for me.
Was that when you were pregnant? Did you notice a change in him?
So not so much when I was pregnant, but when I left. I was very, oh, yes. I was still very, very, very much in his hands when I was pregnant. But as soon as I became more independent, more wanting to do things for myself, that's when things got really out of control.
Yeah, I've just made a note here to myself to ask you that. It seems to me that until you started to show some signs of independence and, let's say, fighting back a little bit, like, you can't treat me like that, or I should be able to go where I want to, I don't know, whatever. But I wonder if that's when he couldn't suppress that those behaviours anymore, because you were learning about independence and the fact that he was controlling you. That would be very conflicting for him, I imagine, and I'm not making excuses for him, please, but he's obviously seen that you are, let's say, blossoming. I don't know, that's probably the wrong word, but you are becoming independent, and he doesn't like it because he's not in control.
Yeah, and he's making that choice to be controlling or, and be abusive or not, because when he's out with people, he's controlling the behaviour. It's when he's not with people, he's not controlling that behaviour. So he's choosing to be abusive.
Did you ever see, like, I don't know, let's say you're at a party or a function or a barbecue, did you ever see him trying to control anyone else, any signs whatsoever?
Not really. I mean, he's trying to control the conversation. So he would maybe trying to get other people on side. You know, if I'd done something stupid, he'd maybe try and get other people to pile on and make jokes at my expense, but not really ever much starting with other people, unless it was too, you know, other than he's a great salesman and trying to sell things, but not really did I see it as that.
Yeah. Interesting that his father sort of ignored the behaviour when he yelled at you, your husband yelled at you for dropping the, I don't know what it was, something on the carpet.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting that his father just ignored that? Like, I would find that would be a shock to hear your son or your, you know, somebody you know so well to treat somebody like that. It'd be,
what's interesting is seeing how often good people do nothing.
Yeah. I think by calling it out, and my friend, the relationship completely changed when he did call out.
It would,
yeah. And so I suppose you've got to weigh up, you know, what sort of a friend is this that I can't say something like that and they say, yeah, you're right, I probably should go and get some help, to just completely alienating them. And it's completely changed a whole lot of relationships by my friend actually calling it out. So it's a big thing to call it out, isn't it? It takes Absolutely. A lot of strength and courage. Mm.
Yeah, that it does take a lot of courage. Of course it does.
Yeah. You said at one point that your husband refused to seek help, and that is such a typical behaviour of a narcissist, isn't it? They don't believe it's them, it's everyone else.
Absolutely.
How did he react when you suggested, and you've said a couple of times, you've early in the relationship, you suggested maybe going and seeing someone, but I imagine as you realised the relationship was irretrievable, that you've suggested going to see him, going to see someone to help with these behaviours. How did he react?
He was angry. It was, you know, he
Why
really,
doesn't that surprise me?
Yeah, he'd never believed it was his fault. I had begged him for years to go for help, and my children had actually begged him to go for help. They could see that something was not good in those, you know, that year or so before things really got bad. They wanted him to go and get some help. And then when the court asked him to go and get some help, they sent him to a men's behavioral change group and they sent him for therapy, and he did everything to get around that. And he just took it as a challenge of how can I get out of this? Nothing was ever, he never ever accepted any responsibility or accountability. And if he had, you know, there's a very small chance for narcissists to recover, but he may have gotten better.
And that's, again, one of those what ifs.
Yeah.
You know, it's too late now because, and we'll get to that shortly about your husband not being with us anymore. But can you talk to before about the children? Can you share with us how, like, this sort of a relationship, this toxic relationship that you're in, must have affected the kids? Can you tell us about how it affected them at the time, but more so now that they're older and they've been able to talk to you about it?
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.